I am from beyond. Listen, and all you desire will be yours. Welcome to Spider-Dan and the Secret Wars. Prepare for battle.
Spider Knight?
Alas, friend Spider-Man, by what sorcery doth small ceiling torch shine forth?
It's called a light bulb.
Welcome to Brattleworld. I'm your host, the ever-amazing, ever-spectacular Spider-Dan. And in this podcast, I spotlight entertainment's best-kept secrets that a mainstream audience may find boring. And welcome to another edition of Spider-Knights of the Round Table, where my guest and I will discuss a much-loved subject in depth in a round-table manner. Welcome back, guys. We are back in full force, celebrating the release of the final Joker trailer, which will be out on the 3rd of October, I believe. And I have a very special guest, a very hilarious guest, a funny guest, the clown prince of comedy himself, Dan Kietis, is back!
I am. Thank you so much for having me back on Prattleworld. You do realise that now you've said that, I won't be able to muster a single funny thing or witticism for an hour and a half. I'll be incredibly... In fact, I'm going to go out of my way to be as dull as possible throughout this podcast.
Just get out. Just get out now.
Okay.
Just leave.
I think the podcast would be richer for it.
What, me on my own? Oh, he's already in. He's already in character.
I am
here.
Very much so.
He's here already. Well, I wanted to bring you on for your comedy stylings and because of your in-depth love of all things Batman and the Joker.
Very much so, yeah.
And I've picked a storyline which is quite an unusual storyline, but it does go in line with the new movie as we're seeing the kind of creation of the Joker from going from a kind of human being, a relatable figure, to, you know, an arch villain of maniacal proportions. So this is kind of almost the reverse of that.
Yeah, it's sanity and back again.
Like that. What a trip.
Sociopath's tale.
The tale of two sociopaths.
Well, very much so. Pretty much.
So welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. I'm well. Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk comics with you. I think in the sort of in an age where everyone is a nerd.
Yes.
And superhero comics and mythologies are so much a staple now of pop culture. They're such a big part of our cinema, our television, our streaming services, which are becoming such a big part of the way we consume media. I feel like maybe comics are getting lost in the shuffle a little bit.
Definitely. In fact, Marvel 1000 has a story by Neil Gaiman,
mm-hmm.
and it features Marvel Man, a character that he had a lot of input on.
Yes. Or Miracle Man.
Miracle Man, yes, you're right. So there's been a lot of there's a lot of rights issues. You can delve into that character and the various YouTube videos on the kind of rights issues with that. But he writes he's trying to understand human beings. And he is looking through comics to kind of understand them through why they create these characters, why they create these larger than life characters. And in it, the character and the writer Neil Gaiman says that it is a dying art form.
It is. Yeah? It's sad because these are the characters that have, for generations, defined what morality is.
Mm.
And certainly as a kid growing up in the 80s, Superman and, was my moral compass, you know. Yeah. And while as much as I was drawn to comics from the Christopher Reeve films, obviously I was like seven years old in 1989. So the Superman Christopher Reeve films and the sort of Michael Keaton, Tim Burton Batman films were a very big part of my sort of cultural palette growing up. But it's those experiences that brought me to comics and just the nuance and complexity that you can tell in comic book stories that you can't really get elsewhere. Like, for example, I'm currently read, I mean, I'm taking a bit of a deviation to read the story that we're going to talk about shortly, but I'm currently reading the Nightfall saga. Mm. Now, when it first came out, I didn't actually read it in comic book form, but I read the novelization by Denis O'Neil, which I thought was incredibly in-depth and nuanced, but you don't get anywhere near as much in terms of content as you do reading the comics, because it is this very serialized art form where you're telling a story, a very singular story across several titles in a lot of cases, across a space of, you know, months or years. And it's a really, really interesting sort of art form. But also, in the age where the MCU is kind of the dominant cultural force in our sort of zeitgeist, as it were, it's really interesting is how that has conditioned mainstream audiences to expect gratification from storytelling. Like everything is queuing up the next issue, as it were. Well, it's very interesting.
The Marvel movies, I think, I listened to Kevin Smith podcast quite a bit, Fat Man on Batman. I had Mark Bernardin, who's the kind of co-podcaster on there. He says that Marvel have made us, made movie lovers a lover of continuity. And that's one of the things that I love about comic books, that one story can relate and affect and have a knock-on effect for so many years. If you look at something like The Killing Joke, Appreciate it as an anti-continuity tale, but it was within the continuity.
Oh, and it had massive like ripple in terms of like Barbara Gordon stopping me, Batgirl becoming Oracle. It had like it stands on its own perfectly well, but it had massive sort of implications for the continuity for decades.
Huge. And her relationship to the Joker and all the other characters, Gordon, Commissioner Gordon, and Batman, all the Robins, Nightwing, the whole Bat family was affected by that one story. It's only 40 pages or something like that. From Alan Moore and Brian Bolland. The artworks is incredible. I did get it signed by Brian Bolland, I believe, a few years ago. But yeah, there you go. It's the continuity, and we love continuity. And, you know, DC does tend to reset quite a bit, but they also do retain a lot of the continuity.
Well, I think continuity is kind of a double-edged sword, and sorry to deviate, but I don't want to deviate too much, but I think continuity is very much a double-edged sword. And I think certainly in a few years down the line, we'll get to the point where mainstream audiences find the continuity a little bit confusing. Yeah. And it wouldn't be surprising at all if we had some sort of Crisis on Infinite Earths kind of a reboot, well, resetting.
Technically, we're getting that in the Flarrowverse or the Arrowverse.
Oh, yes, of course.
They're doing a massive crossover that's based on that very event.
Well, they're throwing everything but the kitchen sink in there, aren't we? We're getting Brandon Routh as Kingdom Come Superman. We're getting Kevin Conroy as aging Bruce Wayne.
Batman Beyond Batman.
Somehow Burt Ward. They're going to stuff him into a Robin suit at 70 odd years old. Bring it the fuck on. I'm all for it.
Like, I'll be honest, I've kind of fell out of, not favor, but kind of fell out of kind of watching, you know, five shows on the go constantly.
Yeah, I mean, I was here for, I think, Arrow season 1 and 2 and the first season of Flash, and then after that, I was just kind of, I'm clearly not the target audience for this. And a lot of people have read it. I know, like, going back to Kevin Smith, he's spoken very passionately about it, but it just doesn't speak to me, I'm afraid. Although, like, I do want to get into Supergirl at some point, but when I'll be able to get into that is anyone's guess.
The first season of Supergirl, I really enjoyed. I'll be honest, the main villain they had at the end, I made like a post about it, and it was like, how many shits do I give about the main villain Supergirl? And it's none, because that's the character's name. that was my joke. So humorous. See, comedy, and that's what we're all about here. But you were talking about fans and comic books and comic book fans. And non-comic book fans as well. Like, a lot of people get in, you know, through video games now. Cartoons or movies and various other things. And they announced the new part of the Disney World was the Avengers Campus. I think that was at D23 with loads of other announcements as well. And they announced that it would be called Avengers Campus. And I went, and my friend was like, look at this. And I was like, why don't you not call it Avengers Academy? Because that's a comic. It's got alliteration, which Stan Lee loved. You know, why not? And they were like, and my friend was like, well, they don't want any bloody sweaty nerds there, do they? Because, you know, they're not going to do stuff from the comics. And I went, It's all from the comics. Like, that's the main demographic. You know, fair enough, you've got kids and families and stuff. The main demographic is people that love that shit.
Oh, they're taking our babies from us, Dan. What are we going to do? Our babies.
And he's making fun of me for loving it. I was like, you're a fucking nerd as well. You're a fucking sweaty nerd as well. Because you love the movies. That you love it. That makes you a nerd. And you sweat. So you're a sweaty nerd.
as much as I'm opposed to sort of gatekeeping, and it does upset me a little bit when people say, pick up a fucking comic book, bruh. As much as I'm opposed to sort of that kind of mentality, I think we need to embrace the fact that we are all nerds now, and we need to embrace the impact that these characters, these kinds of mythologies, and this mode of storytelling have had on our popular culture, because it's not going away. Even if superheroes go away altogether anytime soon, like this idea of shared universes and shared continuities, I don't envisage that going away anytime soon. Even if it comes out in things other than superhero movies, I think we will get a lot more emphasis on this version of shared continuities, shared universes, and this idea of telling stories across various media. Which we're seeing a lot of sort of comics based on video games now, including one of probably the best DC comics of the decade, which is the Injustice series.
Oh my God, so good. I've only read the first 3 years of the Injustice comic, but I binged them in about a day.
It's so good. It is so good.
It's so bingeable. And it's like very accessible as well for fans. Like they're there, but they're kind of introduced to the characters. It's not inaccessible in a way that some DC properties are, in certain continuities.
Well, that's why I say continuity is a double-edged sword, because the Injustice continuity is very much its own like pocket universe, like the Arkham games. Mm-hmm. Like the Arkham games are very much a kind of like a mishmash of the animated series and the Nolan films and the Burton films and a little bit of the comics as well. And it's all kind of like hodgepodge into its own little self-contained continuity. But yeah, it's cool. It's all good stuff.
Spam.
No, I was going for League of Gentlemen.
Oh, sorry, you went full Python. So I went full. I mean, it's only a hop, skip, and a jump away, really.
Yeah.
So let's get back on track. That's some good stuff.
Thank you.
Let's get back to the Joker. The Joker movie is coming out.
Yes.
Initially, I wasn't too keen on the idea of having a solo Joker movie.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
But I'm sure we'll discuss it in a little bit further, but I saw the final trailer that was released recently, and I'm up for it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's produced by Martin Scorsese, directed by Todd Phillips of Hangover and Road Trip fame. There's some genuine comedy kind of background. Yeah. So, and it looks like it's very much inspired by kind of Taxi Driver.
Oh yeah, yeah. King of comedy.
Mean Streets. Yeah, all of that. And I think that's a really good fit for Gotham.
Big time. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm very excited to kind of sit. And I think, you know, Joaquin Phoenix looks very unique, and his take on it might be maybe one of the best. Who knows?
Absolutely. I'm very wary of this term definitive.
Yes.
Because I hope that we're going to see more of Jared Leto's version of the Joker, and I'm happy for him to be our sort of in-universe Joker.
Yeah.
I know that the Joker is going to have an appearance of some sort in Birds of Prey. I don't think it's going to be Leto himself, but it's going to be very much modeled on that type of Joker.
Okay.
And that's the beauty of these comic book characters, is they're so malleable. They can be whatever you want them to be. And the reason they've survived this long, as we've talked about at length in various podcasts, is the fact that they lend themselves so well to interpretation and reimagination. And every decade has its own Joker. Like, I grew up in the sort of age where Cesar Romero was my Joker, and then Jack Nicholson was my Joker, and holy shit, here's this guy Heath Ledger, who I only knew from Brokeback Mountain, and then for the kids who are now sort of in their sort of mid to late 20s, he is their Joker, you know, and it's really interesting to see how different sort of cultural media serve as sort of mirrors for these fictional characters, and we sort of process them and reinterpret them as audiences in different ways. And I've sort of gone on a bit of a tangent where I'm not quite sure, but right. Yes, I'm very much looking forward to this Joaquin Phoenix version of the Joker. I think it's going to be an interesting character study, and like I just want to sort of address, because a lot of people are preparing to be annoyed or outraged or upset by this notion of the Joker.
Also, I think there's people preparing for going, oh, this is Oscar worthy, this is this. And I think there's two ends of the spectrum. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I think there's something to be said for people being like angry that it's not this. But I mean, a lot of people, I mean, I didn't mind the Jared Leto version. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't hate it. I didn't necessarily like, I wasn't bowled over because we didn't get a lot of him in Suicide Squad.
There's a lot that ended up on the, I mean, we did a podcast about Suicide Squad back in the day, but from what I understand, there is a lot that was left on the cutting room floor. Leto himself was quite upset about how much of his performance was left out of the film. Yeah. In the extended version, which is on the Blu-ray, there is more of it.
Yeah.
And it is all good. So, I mean, like, say what you will about Jared Leto, he's a good actor.
Yeah,
he's an incredibly accomplished actor. Yeah. And
Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah, exactly. Alone, yeah. And Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
It's all good stuff, dear. But what excites me is this idea of showing mainstream audiences, okay, this is our main continuity guy. This is our, if you will, Elseworlds guy.
Yeah.
And I think movie studios in particular have been very sort of shy of, well, we can't have concurrent continuities. I remember there was a thing a few years ago about how, no, we absolutely cannot have Harley Quinn in the Arrowverse.
Right.
But now we've got sort of concurrent, we've got Superman on the big screen and we've got Superman on the small screen. Like, yeah. people are coming around to the fact that, no, it's fine. We can have different interpretations of these characters sort of in the pop culture conversation at the same time.
This is what I always thought DC should have done, because like these characters are so iconic. Denny O'Neill describes Batman like Hamlet. There's so many different interpretations
yes.
that can be made of a classic character.
Yes.
And I think that instead of... I know DC tried to follow the Marvel route of the shared universe, and that makes sense. You know, I totally agree. But I thought, why not do... a lot of the best DC stories, in my opinion, tend to be Elseworld stories or stories that are out of continuity.
Yeah.
For the most part. I mean, there are a lot still in continuity, which are great, but a lot of them are outside of continuity. Red Sun, you know, Dark Knight Returns, all those sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So why not do them? Why not have every 2 years another actor gets to play that Hamlet?
Yes.
You know, because it's a part you share. It's not a part that is entirely you. Like, yes, Heath Ledger's Joker was amazing. I like Jack Nicholson's Joker. It doesn't make it any worse or less or
no I think I think and as well I think we do have this sort of and I know that like a lot of the sort of I mean I used to write for CBR so I know what it's like to like have this pressure to sort of like categorize and denigrate and reduce everything to a listicle of who are the best at doing
exactly,
something
yeah.
It's like, and I think that's a bit of a disservice to, I mean, I like eating and having a roof over my head, so I did it. But like, I think that does denigrate this idea of, okay, you personally can think this is the best, but everything, like, it's that Stan Lee thing. Every comic is somebody's first comic, and
yes.
every interpretation of a character is their first interpretation, and they will naturally gravitate towards that because that's the one they grew up with.
Yeah.
A new one might come along that they prefer,
yeah.
but that first one will always, like their first love will always have a special
there's,
place in
the
heart.
There's elements of the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies I like. There's elements of the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movies I like. There's elements of the Tom Holland movies I like.
Yes.
That doesn't invalidate them. It doesn't make any of them worse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I think just to go on a bit of a tangent, because I think I've been seeing a lot of, I try and stay quite active on Twitter, just to sort of like see what the sort of mood is in the geeky sort of milieu. And I've seen a lot of people talking about Spider-Man recently.
Ah, yes.
And we'll get to what I'm going to in a minute, but like a lot of people sort of categorizing Spider-Man. I really don't think that they're comparable.
Yeah.
I think they're very different. I mean, like, you look
there's no aggregate, really.
No, there isn't. And everyone has brought something new to the table. And I think when you get the same thing, like, I think we're conditioned to want the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
That's why people queue up to go to McDonald's or Starbucks. We're conditioned to want the same thing because we have a finite amount of money and we want to know what we're getting for it. And I get that. But I think when you get the same thing again and again and again, that's when things stagnate.
Mm.
And so I want different interpretations of different things. And like, as much as it might be sort of, it might gore me that we're probably not going to see Ben Affleck as Batman again, or I mean, I'm really keeping my fingers and toes crossed that we'll see Henry Cavill as Superman again. But like, as much as I do, so, there are things that I want to see endure in the sort of pop culture conversation.
Yeah.
I don't think we benefit, and I certainly don't think these characters benefit from more of the same over and over and over and over again. And I think as generations sort of grow older and more cognizant of what's going on in pop culture, I think we do need to have different reinterpretations of these characters, because otherwise they'll go the way of, like, I don't know, the Phantom, or the Shadow,
where
they're like, there are people who know and love those characters, but, you know,
they're not in the social consciousness.
Well, yeah, you're not going to catch any, like, 13-year-old kids having, like, arguments over who's better, the Shadow or the Spider, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Green Hornet or something like that. I mean, they're all very good, and they've all got their own kind of popular comic book series as well currently.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, only for fans of those characters,
very much from
years gone by.
And also, like, The Rocketeer, I think, was recently cancelled just because there wasn't the audience demand from it. And that's just really sad.
I mean, Joe Johnston, the director of Captain America, The First Avenger, he did the original Rocketeer.
That's possibly, I think, other than the original Thor, I think The First Avenger is one of the most underrated Marvel films. I got so much affection for that film. I absolutely love, like, the frame of it.
Like, I understand that it, I mean, there's not issues with it, but it feels quite lengthy. I think there's a lot of stuff going on, maybe not as many action pieces as people would like, but that made me fall in love with Captain America over again, because I got his journey, I understood his journey, I felt with him, well, I felt him, you know, his journey all the way through, understand his plight. It's not a perfect movie, but I do love it.
Much of subsequent films works because they made you fall in love with Skinny Steve.
Yeah. You know, who knew that would be the best Marvel trilogy?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, I will categorically say
pound for
that,
pound, yeah.
That is the strongest trilogy in the Marvel universe. You know, we can't say about Guardians yet, or, you know, whatever is coming. You know, we don't even know about the future of Spider-Man. That's still uncertain.
Tangents are the norm on Prattle World.
Yes. We've not even talked about the Joker, really, yet.
But just before we do, I want to just, obviously, we have had a very big piece of Spider-Man news. Obviously, at the time of recording, because I do think this is subject to change. Marvel Studios or Disney and Sony have not come to terms on an extension of the Spider-Man contract.
Mm-hmm.
So it's looking like we will still get films with Tom Holland.
Yeah.
And Zendaya, and
so any Spider-Man related characters that Sony owns,
yes,
they have control of.
Yeah,
you won't get a Jon Favreau.
No,
you won't get a, you know,
poor Aunt May loses her stable relationship.
Right? It's just gone. So any links, you know, any hints or anything to the MCU are totally gone. You know, that's still, I mean, I'm not sure the director's still involved. That's still a bit.
Yeah, that seems up in the air at the minute.
We'll see. I hope he is, because I think he's very good. I think he does a good job. I feel bad. I feel the worst for Tom Holland at the moment, because he was riding high. His film made $1 billion. You know, he's in a great place. He's Spider-Man. He's known the world over. He's doing things like the current war. You know, he's getting all that kind of work, some great quality work outside of the MCU as well. He's doing a Disney movie, Pixar movie. So I feel worse for him than all of the fans, I think.
I mean, from what I gather, there are still plans for him to go ahead and be Spider-Man in films.
And I think the main thing is they want to tie Venom, because Venom made a lot of money. Whether you like it whether you like it or not, Venom made a lot of money. And I think they want to have their Venom Spider-Man story.
Yeah.
And fair enough.
I don't dislike Venom.
No.
I've given it a bit of shit because it's not as good a film as maybe it's as good a film as it deserves to be, because like Venom is very much one of those sort of, he's one of those products of sort of like late 80s, early 90s comic excess.
Yeah,
exactly. And obviously the comic run we're going to talk about is very much of its time. And as someone who's been reading a lot of, reading a lot of 90s comics, Fire Nightfall, there is kind of that, it's like, it's kind of like Suicide Squad. It kind of has a sort of punk sensibility to it, where I can kind of forgive the ways in which it doesn't conform to what a quote unquote good film is.
Yeah.
I do need to rewatch that one, yeah. to be fair.
I went in with like the lowest of expectation, yeah, yeah. and I came out pleasantly surprised. But yeah, so I believe there's still a deal that can be done. I think the only reason that Spider-Man made that much money is because it was connected to the MCU. I don't think your average MCU fan would have gone to see a Spider-Man movie like if it's not connected to the MCU.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
I think maybe
a comic book fan would go and see a Spider-Man movie, but I don't think the regular going audience would necessarily go see it.
Spider-Man definitely has enough sort of cultural currency.
Oh yeah.
Spider-Man in terms of merchandising outsells every other superhero. Like, mm-hmm. I think the only one that comes close is Batman, but like the difference is leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
Like kids especially love Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And because he's just such a relatable character who kids can project themselves onto.
Yeah, cool.
And we talked, I think, about like how the mask covers his face, so Spider-Man can be anyone. And
yeah.
Going back to the whole like Into the Spider-Verse thing, yeah. Spider-Man, you can
put
the mask.
Anybody can put on.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Spider-Man can be black, he can be Latin, he can be Asian, he can be woman, whatever you want. So long as you embrace this idea of like power and responsibility becoming incrementally,
yes,
that's always going to be a good sort of maxim.
Yeah.
So I think like Spider-Man will always have cultural currency. I think the MCU thing certainly helps because we have been conditioned as consumers, and when we sit in a cinema, that's what we are consumers. We have been conditioned to be loyal to brands. Mm. To a certain extent, I think we don't even watch films anymore. We become brand advocates.
Yeah.
And as someone who writes a lot about branding as for a living, it's kind of scary how we are becoming kind of tribal in our brand allegiances.
Mm.
And as much as I am a massive sort of DCU fanboy / apologist, yeah, I am very cognizant of the fact that we really need to think about like tribalism and how much we advocate for brands and say, okay, well, I'm sticking my flag on this brand, everything else sucks. Which is, unfortunately seems to be the discourse for quite a lot of fandom and
online. I think the Marvel DC war goes on. I think there was I was saying to you earlier, there was some sort of ad or something. I've not seen it myself, but there's a DC ad of some kind dissing Thanos and kind of praising Darkseid as a character, and I was like, the war continues.
I mean, not to be all sort of in my day everything was awesome, because yeah, I grew up in the sort of 80s and 90s, so obviously not the Iraq war, but like it seemed that there was kind of a good-natured aspect to the sort of DC, yeah, Marvel, like
Marvel called DC the distinguished competition.
Yeah, and I remember. Do you know what it is? I remember. I think it might have been on the Daredevil DVD special features, or maybe the first Spider-Man, one of the two. There was an interview with Joe Quesada, and he was saying that like we're the sort of hot-blooded Latin family of comics, whereas we're at DC they're all very sort of waspish and very prim and proper.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, but be passionate one way or the other.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fine. If you're a passionate DC fan, that's absolutely fine. If you're a passionate Marvel fan, great. But like apathy is death, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, exactly,
that always stuck with me for some reason. Mm. But it's like, I think we're sort of equal, because I'm like 60% DC,
yeah,
and 40% Marvel, but I will like I'm totally in love with both,
yeah,
and I will show up and open.
I think I'm the same percentage, just the other way.
Exactly, yeah, and we'll both show up for anything from the other camp.
No, yeah,
either way, on opening night, but we have a slight bias one way or the other. But it's just interesting how we have been conditioned to sort of not so much consume media or consume art as align ourselves with brands. And that kind of worries me a little bit, because we live in an age where marketing is the content. Almost,
yes,
like,
yeah, yeah.
We whenever a new trailer for something drops, we get a whole news cycle around that. Mm. And because news outlets, again, I wrote for CBR, I know news outlets need clicks. That's how they get paid. That's how they pay their writers. And so that is a cycle that has to perpetuate itself. Otherwise, it just stops.
Mm.
And in an age where we have that kind of economy, and we're in an age where, you know, people are making a living from playing video games in their rooms,
yeah,
and getting Patreons. Like, it's just a very, very interesting economy. And again, like, people make a living off the value of their brand. And I know that's how it's always been.
Yeah.
But like, the digital age has become this sort of like great leveler of how we can all sort of like, we can all be our own brand and commoditize that brand. And it's just very interesting. And I know I'm going on a massive tangent.
It's all right.
But like, this idea of you're either DC or you're either Marvel. And this, and as someone spends a lot of time on Twitter just seeing so much, oh, DC's shit, or Marvel.
There's a lot of vitriol.
Yeah. Or like, oh, if you like the MCU, that's basically the McDonald's of cinema, and it's just,
yeah, don't shit on what I love for no reason at all.
And like, just because something's popular doesn't mean it doesn't have artistic merit, and just because something's like brand
taking
B is
taking a chance,
just because brand B is less popular than brand A doesn't mean there's no artistic merit in that either.
Pepsi and Coke are both still going strong, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
None is necessarily better than the other. It's a product of an opinion, mm-hmm. and that is your own thing. It's your own opinion. And in some cases, just keep it to yourself.
Yeah. Joker. Yeah.
Yes, anyway. Speaking of opinions, we're going to tell you ours.
Very, very excited for Joker. I'm very excited for just seeing a film that is where I don't have to worry about continuity. I don't have to worry about, oh, I remember this note from the comics.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm very much looking forward to, we're taking the basic premise of this character, yep. and we're putting it in a framework that you may not be used to consuming.
Exactly, exactly. And I think the director even said that we've not taken any inspiration from the comics, which it could be good or could be ill. We don't know. We haven't seen the movie. But let's talk about Batman going sane.
Yes, yes, let's do that. Yeah, we kind of buried the lead on this.
A little bit.
Not actually mention it at all.
So this is I think it's an early 90s, mid-90s comic,
yes.
in Legends of the Dark Knight by J.M. DeMatteis and Joe Staton,
yes.
Was the artist on it. And this was Batman Legends of the Dark Knight, Volume 1, issues 65 to 68. So,
I mean, did Klaus Janson have, was he a colorist on it, or?
Possibly. It's very Klaus Janson-esque.
There's kind of a Dark Knightiness to the artwork.
There is, yeah. very much that. So J.M. DeMatteis wrote Kraven's Last Hunt.
Yes.
He is known for doing these kind of deep dives into the psychology of the villains.
Yes, like, very much so.
He's really, really good. I read one of his amazing Spider-Man issues about the Vulture. He accidentally killed off Aunt May's lover and Nathan Lubensky. And he comes back and he basically he's going to die of cancer. He's ended up kind of tailing off all the things that he needs to do before he dies. And he goes and Spider-Man thinks he's going to kill her, but he's actually apologizing for his death because he used to be a friend of his as well.
Okay.
Some really good stories. He writes, I mean, he does heroes great as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just villains, but Kraven's Last Hunt is a comic book masterpiece and one of the best Spider-Man stories ever written. And it's not even really about Spider-Man. It's more about Kraven, this second tier villain. Anyway, so this story is basically, what if Batman died? What would the Joker do?
Mm.
So, you know, how would he, you know, because the relationship they have is very much like the two opposites. They're in this constant clash, order, chaos, good, evil. You know, they exist. They're both in this perpetual war of good and evil. But what happens if one just goes away? And in the story, it's not spoilers because it happens in the first issue. Joker seemingly kills off Batman. We see basically the Joker decides, you can take it either way. Either he goes back to who he was prior to falling into the vat of acid. The Joker's never really had a set origin. So much like in The Dark Knight with Heath Ledger, he comes up with a different story every time, how he got these scars and how he became who he was. So in this, I'm not necessarily sure if we're going back to... So in the comics, there's very various iterations of the origin. But in this one, I personally believe he creates a new personality. I believe he creates a new iteration of himself to deal with the loss of Batman. It's the loss of, it's almost a love, I mean, in some interpretations of the Joker, he is a loved one, is almost a homosexual kind of, you know, homoerotic love for Batman. Depends on the writer, depends on the depiction of the character. But I think the loss of that and the end of the game, so to speak, has created a character who's, he names himself Joseph Kerr. Get it? Joker. So he becomes basically, he's just an average regular guy. He tends to like, you know, old comedy, you know, Laurel and Hardy, Chaplin, all that sort of stuff. But he's generally just your average, literally an average Joe. And that's where the story goes. Now, I want to ask you, Dan, do you think the Joker, do you see the Joker as a character, or do you see him more as a kind of, a force of nature?
A condition.
Like, yes. Yeah. It's just like, he does he just come along and he's just chaos incarnate, and does he just tear stuff off? Do we need to know he's human underneath? Do we need to know his backstory? Do we need to know that he's relatable on some level?
I'm kind of torn, because I do like the sort of this idea of the Joker is a force of nature. It doesn't matter where he came from. It doesn't matter what his origins are. And again, there's the whole, like, quite a lot of the controversy with the current trailer is, should we be sympathizing with the Joker? And I think a lot of the problem is the fact that we use the terms protagonist and hero interchangeably in our culture. And that's kind of a big sort of cultural mistake that we're all making. But also, I think the world and society progresses when we do empathize with the monster, and we do sort of understand. Interestingly, I'm listening to a podcast at the moment which delineates the sort of differences between Eastern and Western thought, in terms of we in the West thinking in terms of very binary good and bad, you know, righteous and evil.
Yeah.
But in Eastern mentalities, it's not quite as straightforward as that, and it's this idea of who you are is not in a vacuum. It's not a fundamental thing. Like, you aren't born good, which is absolutely true. You become good or bad as a result of external influences. That might be your upbringing. It might be something that happens to you personally. It might be something you experience. It might be sort of certain proclivities that arise in childhood. But this idea, like, I certainly don't think that we shouldn't empathize with the Joker. There's this weird sort of oversimplification that empathizing with the Joker means we condone the things he does, when he's bollocks.
Yeah.
It's just total nonsense. So what I think is really interesting is this idea of, I mean, the story's called Going Sane.
Yes.
This idea of pinning our mania on an external, like, I think it's a very Jungian thing, this idea of pinning our mania on an external tormentor. And when that is taken out of the picture, we are suddenly free. And what happens in this story is the Joker seemingly killed Batman. And I when I first read this, I thought, oh, it's Legends of the Dark Knight, an out of continuity thing. And it turns out it's in continuity, but it's like an early years thing. You can basically tell whatever story you want, as long as everything snaps back to normal by the end.
Yeah, it's usually, I think it's kind of like just shortly after kind of year one.
Yeah.
Of year two or it's year three.
It's a year two kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of thing. So
that when I read that kind of made sense. I really like this idea of sort of what is Joker without Batman, you know, and in so many iterations, Joker is a direct result of Batman.
Yes.
You know, ideologically and physically, you know, he's knocked into the acid by Batman.
Mm. That's the one kind of constant in all the origins is it's the Red Hood guys. He falls into the acid. We don't know who he is because he's wearing the Red Hood. So we have no idea who he could be. So again, he could be anybody. He can be Jack Napier. He can be a Joseph Kerr. He can be whatever the character's name is in the Joaquin Phoenix version.
Arthur Fleck.
There you go. So it could be anybody. That's the kind of one thing. It's the bleaching of the skin and the madness, but that is it. Everything else is subject to whatever the writer deems worthy.
And that, like, the this notion of, like, the Joker being something that you can, like, scrub off with with like surgery and they've done the same thing with Two-Face, to be fair. I think in the kind of like Hush era,
yeah
they did the same thing with Two-Face, this idea of, well, if we fix, and it's a very, very Western thing, if we fix the outside because we're so appearance orientated in
also,
our culture.
It does a Two-Face, it comes up quite a lot actually. It comes up in Don't I Returns as well. Treated him mentally, we've also given them surgery, and it's like, no, that doesn't fix the problem.
Exactly. And what I really appreciated about reading the book is just this little moment, and it's a page, I think, or half a page, and it's just little panels where you see the same facial expression, and then you see almost this like involuntary twitch of the mouth where it just like it goes into a smile mode and then just goes back into a sort of neutral facial expression. I was like, oh, well, that's really powerful. This idea of the idea that Joker's a sort of neurological compulsion that he just kind of
could tick.
You can change the color of your skin and your face. You can't change this like this little thing that's inside. But like, I also liked how Jem Dimitrescu, like you said, he's a big fan of like getting under the skin of the characters. I remember when we talked about Craven's Last Hunt, there's this bit with the spiders converging on Peter Parker, and this idea of like sort of being consumed by your totem, if you like. Quite a few dream sequences in this story where Joker or Joseph Kerr, remind me, I need to talk about that. He's having these nightmares where he's seeing this big bat, and you think, oh, okay, he's having nightmares about Batman. And then you realize, no, the bat has a clown's face, and he's having nightmares about Batman and Joker being locked in. They're kind of interchangeable almost. They're locked into this struggle together. And I think what these four issues do really well is sort of underline the inherent tragedy and how doomed both characters are, and how they're not imprisoned by each other. They're imprisoned within themselves, but they are each other's catalysts. And I think like they have exactly the same arc, you know, I think because you've got Joker falling in love with this woman and starting a life, and they have common interests. And interestingly, in the artwork, everything starts off very sort of comic booky, very 90s comic booky. Like jagged lines and primary, vivid primary colors. But then when he goes sane in the second issue, everything is very, very neutral color palette, and the lines soften a little bit. And I was just like, ooh, okay, I like that. I appreciate that.
That's definitely like, it's an artistic choice to do that.
Big time.
And I think I'm pretty sure in the second issue we see, up until the final page, I'm pretty sure we don't see any Batman.
No, we don't.
It is purely a Joseph Kerr book.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed, basically, Batman disappears, presumed dead, for this length of time.
And I genuinely thought they killed him off, because I thought it was out of continuity.
Because it was out of continuity, And that would have been interesting as well. That's interesting to see as well. But so we see Jim Gordon, every so often will turn on the bat signal and then sadly turn it off. You've got Alfred.
Yeah, Alfred rattles around in the cave.
There's this shot of Alfred, or this panel of Alfred, and he's just stood there with all the trophies, all the costumes, the Batmobile and everything, and he's just so morose.
And he's just going through the motions, isn't he? He's just tired of everything. So that's the only way you can deal with...
Yeah, and this is like Alfred's biggest fear, that he's let down, you know, Thomas and Martha.
Yeah.
And he's let their little boy go off and do this mad obsession. You know, that's what we're talking about, is that it's not just the Joker who goes sane.
Mm-hmm.
Batman has a portion of this story where he questions his quest, his desire for justice and vengeance, because he kind of gets a taste of the normal life.
Yeah, and they both kind of fall in love in a way.
Yeah.
And as well, like, it's interesting how he falls in love with a doctor. But also she is a rape survivor.
Yeah.
And I think she's a really, like, phenomenally, like, I think both the women in the stories are phenomenally interesting characters. And I'm just betraying myself as an enormous misogynistic prick, because I can't remember their names, because they're not characters I'm used to seeing. And
Don't worry. I've got their names. I've written them down because I also forgot their names. So it's Rebecca Brown is the lady that falls in love with the Joker.
Yes.
And Dr. Lynn Eagles is the woman who saves Batman.
Dr. Eagles,
Dr. Lynn Eagles is who you're just talking about. Please carry on. on.
It's really interesting how they kind of she tells this really sort of impassioned monologue about how she grew up in the suburbs and the city was like this big, exotic, scary, exciting place. And then she went there and then this horrible thing happened to her. And then she built herself up to the point where she was able to go back. And then something similar happened, but then Batman stopped it. And I think that's the sort of pivotal moment for Bruce where he realizes Batman's not just about me.
Yeah.
Like if Batman was just my sort of coping mechanism, then this would be a good time for me to hang up my cape. But Batman means something to people. Like as violent and as sort of extreme as Batman needs to be, and as much as I think if Batman existed in our society, I think we'd be quite condemning of him.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. It's like, no, Batman's not just about me anymore. Like, if I hang up my cape, this could happen again to people, and people will associate Gotham with all the bad things. And what I really appreciate about that monologue that the Dr. Eagles gives is she says about I love the cafes, I love the bookstores, I love the theaters. Like, there's so much to love about Gotham.
Yeah.
But without Batman, all you see is the crime. All you see is the bad stuff, you know. Exactly. And at least they spoke to me.
They have that figure. They have that legend. They have that myth that scares the criminals. You know, the superstitious and cowardly lot. We have that. And that's. I mean, we always have the like Spider-Man's famous for it, questioning the quest. You know, why should I go on? Why should Spider-Man be? You know, Spider-Man no more. You know, all that sort of stuff. And they always come back to, you know, the reason they do it, and they get reminded by somebody. You know, Spider-Man No More is quite a famous story. He bumps into somebody who looks like Uncle Ben. He saves Uncle Ben from a group of muggers, and that inspires him to come back and battle the Kingpin for the first time. And I think it's really important to have that journey, to have that question. And it's really, I think it's really effective in this story, because you're also getting the Joker story as well, and the other side of it. And I'd argue that in this story, like before, like the first issue is very much a standard kind of Batman Joker story. It's very much like Joker turns up, kills some people, does some stuff, standard, what you expect and what you want from a kind of Batman Joker story.
But also, sorry to interrupt, I think what DiMatteis does incredibly well is it was the first time I've been genuinely disturbed by something the Joker does in a long time. And it's one of the tamest, like paradoxically, it's one of the tamest thing the Joker's done. He's just sitting in the cinema watching this sort of Buster Keaton, I think, marathon with his hostage.
It's Councilwoman Kenner.
Catherine Kenner. Yeah. And he just starts punching her in the face, and she sort of drops down and just keeps punching her.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of like really just
disturbed. Yeah.
And that, because that's the violence we can all relate to. You know, like that we can't relate to sort of like, you know, tying up a teenage boy and blowing him up, you know,
and hitting him with a crowbar.
And beating him with a crowbar. We can relate to just seeing someone getting beaten up and like, even though she survives and is perfectly fine, it's just this incredibly sort of almost intimate portrayal of violence, which we're used to seeing a kind of a balletic, almost dancey kind of violence. For example, one of my favorite comic books ever is The Long Halloween.
Yeah.
And we see panel after panel of Joker being punched in the face and his teeth going flying everywhere, but he still has the exact same number of teeth.
Yeah.
We're not used to seeing frankness in comic book violence, and like that was one of the most frank depictions of comic book violence I'd seen in a long time. It just sort of like gave me pause, because
I always think of when I saw Zack Snyder's Watchmen, and that opening scene with the comedian and his attacker.
Yes,
I won't spoil that, but the attacker, and that is very balletic, but it's a really violent, it's a brutal fight, but it is very balletic.
And that's something I really love about the film, is the way in which it doesn't skimp on the sort of the glorification that we get from the comics, but it doesn't shy away from the violence either. So it gives that really wonderful juxtaposition. I could talk about that film for a whole of the podcast.
I'm sure we could.
Please invite me to talk about it.
We'll save that. But when the story starts off, as I was saying earlier, that Batman is really overtly angry and aggressive and determined and obsessed to get the Joker back behind bars to capture him. He's punching computer screens, his own like $1 million per computer screens. He's, you know, all this sort of stuff. And it's very kind of like doggedly determined, but it's also kind of, it's so much so that it's not really relatable. It's kind of like he's so mad, he's so angry.
It's a much less restrained Batman than we're used to seeing in this day and age.
It's very much, it's probably, maybe it's J.M. DeMatteis saying maybe Batman at this point is too dark, maybe it's too aggressive, too grim and gritty. Maybe he's trying to pull it back or maybe put a spotlight. You know, he could be making an examination of 90s comics because there was a lot of that in 90s.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Because that's what sold. That was big. So maybe that was his version. You know, Kingdom Come was very famous for having, is it Gog or Magog?
Magog, yeah.
Yeah, which was a version of Cable, which was one of the archetypal kind of 90s characters.
Big muscles, big guns, big pouches.
Lots of pouches.
Big violence. Exactly. Big everything, yeah.
Tiny, you know, poorly drawn feet. you know, possibly the wrong way around. So maybe there's something like that. I tend to relate more to the Joker in this, like his love for old films, mm-hmm. his love for old comedians, Harold Lloyd and the Charlie Chaplin, Lauren Hardy. You know, I'm a big fan of those as well. Obviously, I don't relate to him beating a councilwoman to us to death, but you know, I can still, you know, like you said, it's not necessarily, we're not condoning what he's doing, but we can relate to him trying to have a normal life, falling in love, and having this, you know, beautiful, you know, genuine connection with somebody. But like you were saying before, when he kind of has Rebecca Brown, the woman he falls in love with, calls them his episodes.
Yes,
and you can see that he's kind of, you know, he's twitching, he's, you know, getting that grin again,
and then he gets like quite sort of aggressive.
Yes, and he almost goes to, because he kind of I think he relives the Councilwoman Kenner experience.
Yes,
and goes to hit Rebecca Brown. She kind of goes, no, I understand that she's always had problems with mental illness, mm-hmm. so she's understanding and supportive and loving no matter what happens. And then, you know, and he asks her to marry him, and she fills a room with bouquets of flowers.
Yeah.
You know, it's lovely.
What's incredibly bittersweet about the story is this idea of when it ends with her saying, "Oh, I hold out hope that he'll come back," because the way the story is framed is that incredibly stormy night, and she assumes that he's been swept away by floods.
Yeah,
but she holds out hope that that he'll come back to her someday. And then it cuts to, I think, the Joker in Arkham Asylum. And just this idea of just sanity returning to his art. And I think there's a thing about where Batman says, like, for a moment he sees sanity return to the Joker's eyes.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I would like to talk about, the artwork a little bit.
Yes, yes, please do.
One of my favorite things that I didn't really notice the first time I read it. It's been a few years. I think 2014 I read it originally.
Okay.
Way, way back. So what I really noticed this time around was the green eyes the Joker has.
Yeah.
How kind of, you know, even though we've got the kind of normal skin tone and the face, no grin, no like maniacal grin, the green eyes really, they really grabbed me, and I could see almost, you know, windows to the soul and everything.
Yeah, 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 big time.
And I think the shade of green was really effective for me. Like, it's almost the same as his hair. It's the kind of light green.
Well, I think it comes back to this thing of the Joker as a condition, you know, and I think in every interpretation I've seen, certainly, the chemical which makes Jack Napier or whatever you want to call him, the Joker, it's always green. So I think the green in the eyes just sort of like goes one a little bit closer to sort of saying,
yeah,
this is something that, because when we see him in the story, he's the Joker, and then it's a massive jump cut, and then he's just this normal dude.
Yes.
And then the sort of the Joker kind of encroaches on his psyche. And I think the Joker has always kind of characterized himself as a state of mind, and especially in like the Nolan films, he this idea of I think he refers to himself as an agent of chaos.
Yeah.
Just this kind of, he's a virus almost, you know, like, and I think in every interpretation of the Joker, we've seen people who will follow him. And I know certainly from reading the Injustice comics, there's been a lot of that, this idea of people who will sort of tear everything down, tear the infrastructure down. And I think this idea
people just want to watch the world burn.
Well, exactly. And but I think especially in this day and age where our infrastructure is kind of decaying, like our political and moral and social infrastructure appears to be falling apart around us, this idea of, okay, let's just tear it all down and then like return to our natural state is kind of appealing almost.
Yeah, I guess in a way. Yeah.
Because the Joker's
the Joker's
often referred to as an anarchist, and as anyone who's read V for Vendetta will tell you, anarchy is life without government, without rules. And I think maybe quite a few comics have dealt with this idea of the Joker as a kind of social malady or a reaction to a socio-political problem. Because again, this we as Westerners cling to this fallacy of people fundamentally good or bad, and that's just not the way it works at all. People are shaped by their circumstances.
Shades of grey.
You know, as someone who's worked in education, you see that if parents are shit to their kids, then if you raise a kid to the age of 7 and shout at them and slap them, they're gonna bully other kids when they get to that age.
Yeah,
you know, it's we are shaped by the world around us and our circumstances and society, politics, history. It all becomes interweaved, and it's all part of what makes us who we are. We like to believe in determinism. We like to believe that we are architects of our own destiny, but we're kind of not.
There was a post not long after the first trailer for the new Joker movie was released. It was basically, it made me laugh, but it was kind of, I related to it. It was like 1989, what turned someone into the Joker? Toxic chemicals. What to 2019, what turns someone into the Joker? Toxic society.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. Actually, yeah. You know, there's the clips of the film that I've seen, like he's making a kid laugh on the bus and people are like beating him up or, you know, making fun of him or making him feel like crap because people think he's unusual or a bit different or, you know, not right in the head or something like that. You know, eventually that's going to have a negative effect.
And also, like, the fact that it's set in the sort of like late 70s, early 80s isn't an accident. You know, it's that era did define a kind of like tonal shift in Western society towards the corporate and the normative. Peace and love had been gone, and it was all about sort of the brand and the message and individualism as well. You had Reaganomics in the UK and Thatcherism in, sorry, Reaganomics in the US and Thatcherism in the UK, and everything became about like, okay, accrue wealth because that is the highest virtue.
But also, like, you know, there was a time where when they were going to do a new Daredevil film, and like a reboot Daredevil film.
I remember that, yeah.
And they were going to set it in Hell's Kitchen in the 70s.
And it was going to be your man, David Slade.
That's right. And they did it because Hell's Kitchen was not in a good place at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, the crime had increased in the 70s, you know, tenfold from any other time in kind of American history at all. And, you know, and so that makes sense to me as well. Like, Gotham would be in a state in the 70s. It would be in a horrible, it would be a lot of corruption, a lot of crime. You know, it would be, you know, a place where someone would, you know, get to a point where they would just snap.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you go to Manhattan now and it's a theme park.
Yeah.
You know, but like, back in the day, almost even going as kind of like, I think post 9/11, New York became a lot more kind of sanitized. But certainly when you go back into, I remember my mum used to live in America in the 70s and she used to tell me horror stories about like New York and how like there were certain areas where you just couldn't go. And yeah,
I remember when I went to New York, I was about 10 or 11. So I don't remember it that well, but I did go up the World Trade Center and various other things.
Yeah, yeah.
So it must have been like 98, 97, maybe. We were on the subway, me and my dad, and a guy came over to us and he was like, "Nice watch." My dad was like, "What? Nice watch. That's a really nice watch." And he was a bit like, "Okay." And then they were like, "Where are you going?" And they're like, "Oh, we're going to visit this, you know, particular monument or, you know, tourist attraction." Went, "Oh, no, wait, you've got to get off here. This is your stop. You've got to get off here." And they're like, "Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks for that. You know." And it was a totally like they were, it was a friendly guy. He was a nice guy. But because he'd approached in a strange manner.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it made my dad quite nervous. And, you know, it's being New York, he was obviously, you know, being careful.
Hackles raised.
Yeah. But again, he was just literally commenting and complimenting my dad on his watch. But because of the reputation and the reputation of New York and the subway, that's where that came from. So that's where that fear was kind of engendered. And it's because of that kind of 70s, 80s kind of crime epidemic that it had.
You know? And I think you've also hit on a key point, which I think is what will probably make the film work and what makes Joker so compelling, is this idea of fear of the other.
Yeah.
Which has always motivated sort of scary stories that make us scared.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's so much more scary if the other could be any one of us.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons why The Killing Joke is one of the most successful Joker stories is this idea of, okay, all it takes is one really, really bad day.
Yeah.
And even though that thesis is proved wrong in the narrative,
yeah, yeah.
There's this idea of, shit, am I one bad day away from being the Joker?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you could be a hop, skip, and a jump away. Maybe not necessarily one bad day, but
because we all have days where we upset, like where we let ourselves down or we scare ourselves a little bit.
Yeah, and you have negative thoughts. You'll have a weird thought, and you'll be like, why the fuck would I think that?
Yeah,
why the fuck would I want that to happen to somebody? Or what the fuck? You would never actually do it, but your brain just all of a sudden just goes, ugh. And there's nothing wrong with that. Your brain just says and does things that you don't, never really understand.
Because we're animals.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And as animals,
you have an impulse.
As animals, we want to create a nest, protect ourselves, and
fuck everybody else.
Eat the food, shit the food, and kill anything that gets in the way of that.
For an example, I will often have, I mean, Peep Show's a great example for random weird thoughts.
Oh yeah, big time.
That are very relatable, they're just random thoughts. But for example, I once spoke to one of my friends at university, and I said, do you ever have random thoughts where you're like, you're in a job interview, and all of a sudden you're like, I wonder what would happen if I punch this guy in the face? I just you would never do it. You're like, this first of all, you wouldn't get the job. Second of all, you might get arrested, so straight away you're going, no, that never happened. But you do have this kind of narrative, and you create this kind of, I know I do anyway, I create this kind of this fake world, and this kind of my own little episode of a TV show or something. And or I go, oh, what if this person just died? How would that affect me? Or where would that lead me? And then I go on a kind of like my own little mental tangent and kind of go and create this whole fictionalization of this person that is not dead, is nowhere near dying, but they've just died. And I'm like, oh yeah, this would be horrible, and this would happen, and that would happen. And it's like, no, that will never, that's not true. But I kind of go, okay, back to real life. Okay, so I think we've covered Joker Go Insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think we both enjoyed it.
Very much so.
I would recommend it. I know it's on CBR's master list of 75 best Joker stories.
Wow, that's a big old list.
It's a big list. Well, there's a lot of Joker stories.
Yeah, yeah.
Batman stories that feature the Joker. So I would highly recommend looking at that if you want to look for a decent Joker story. But I'd like to talk about you and me,
okay,
and our favorite interpretations of the Joker and favorite versions of the Joker from all types of media.
Okay.
So I'll let you go first. Would you like to pick a comic, TV show, cartoon, movie? You go.
Okay. Well, I mean, we need to talk about Killing Joke.
Yes, because
I think that's the first sort of
port of call.
Yeah, yeah. I think, and also it's one of my first sort of exposures to sort of grown-up comics. And I remember when I sort of first read it, it was before they kind of redid the colouring.
Yes.
Which I think, personally, for me, worked to the detriment of the story, because I think the fact that you have these bright, vivid primary sort of comic book colours and such a morally grey story, I think that was an effective juxtaposition. But
yeah,
fair enough. I didn't write the thing, so I don't get to decide. Obviously,
I don't even think Alan Moore decided that.
Well, yeah, I think that was a Brian Bolland thing. But I think Batman 89 obviously is a huge influence on me personally. Jack Nicholson's Joker will always have a special place in my heart. I think the whole mirror. I think that's a phenomenal Joker scene. And
hubba hubba hubba, money. Who do you trust?
But I think the whole idea of this sort of like this kind of personality was always sort of bubbling under the surface, but it's the sort of the catalyst with the acid and Batman that sort of brought it out. I think that kind of worked very well for me. Obviously, I'm in love with Heath Ledger's version. I'm certainly in love with Mark Hamill's version. And the fact that Mark Hamill's Joker has been extrapolated across so many different media. We've got like the Batman the Animated Series. Mm-hmm. I recently watched an episode called Joker's Wild.
Oh, that's a good one. The casino one.
Yes, that's a really good one, because it's just got this idea of like Joker just being in Arkham Asylum, and they're also like this kind of like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest kind of scene where Poison Ivy's trying to watch TV and Joker's just being a dick. I really like that. Batman Beyond: Return of the Joker. Came out when I think I was in my first year at university, and I remember. Like, because I think Amazon was just becoming a thing in the country, and I remember buying Batman Beyond: Return of the Joker and Mask of the Phantasm and Batman Sub-Zero at the same time.
Mask of the Phantasm is a good iteration of the Joker as well.
Absolutely.
It's really good. It's really menacing. Like that version of the Joker, the Mark Hamill version of the original animated series, is my favorite by far, because it kind of has the jokey, weird, comical elements of kind of the kind of mid-50s, 60s kind of campy Joker. It has that element, but there's also like you see him kind of spin on a dime.
All
of a sudden he's like, no, you know, and all that. And he just really...
That's the beauty of, like, I think Mark Hamill, as we've discussed numerous times, is an actor's actor. And I think he can take it wherever you need it to go and still retain everything that works about that version of the character. And I think like going back to Mask of the Phantasm, I remember, like, I think one of the most Joker things in anything is there's this moment where like Batman's beating the shit out of the Joker, and the building around them is blowing up, and Joker just sees everything blowing up all around him, and he just bursts out laughing. And I think that's pretty much everything you need to know about the Joker
There's some, I mean, I would really would go, like, if you're looking for a good Joker, I would go to the animated series. I think Joker's Favour is a really good one. It also introduces Harley Quinn for the first time.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's all about him stalking this guy who cut him up in traffic.
Yes.
He basically just like, he's like, I'm going to learn everything about you.
Yeah, yeah.
I keep hot. And he's like, you've changed your name. You've moved.
He just has this list of people I'm going to fuck with at some point.
Exactly. Like someone who's just pissed him off a little bit. And that, I feel that's just amazing. The Laughing Fish. There's a comic, obviously the comic.
Marshall Rogers and Steve Englehart.
Strange Apparitions is the collection.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Which is a great collection anyway. But that's really good. That has him going. He poisons these fish, gives them the Joker grin, and tries to patent it.
Yep.
And then the guy goes, well, they're a natural resource, so you can't patent it. And he's like, well, you're going to die. You know?
Colonel What's-His-Name has chickens, then you even have mustaches.
There's so many. The Joker isn't like my favorite Batman villain. I'd probably say maybe second or third in my tier.
Okay.
I think Scarecrow for me is number one.
It's interesting. Yeah, yeah.
Just because he's a great kind of foil. Again, like
they both use fear in different ways.
Exactly. And I think that's a really cool concept. But yeah, he's really good. What else? I'm gonna go into comics. So again, like we talked about, Laughing Fish is really good. I recommend the Demon Laughs, which two of the best Batman villains of all time team up, and it's really unique and really interesting. It's Ra's al Ghul, or Ra's al Ghul, however you want to pronounce it, teams up with the Joker, and the Joker even beats him at chess in the story. And it was one of the last stories drawn by the amazing Jim Aparo, who's one of the classic kind of Batman artists, drew quite a lot of the Nightfall saga and various other classic Batman stories.
Didn't he also do Learn the Place of Dying?
Yes, yeah, he did. And Death of the Family, which is another great joke.
Oh, no, sorry, I'm thinking of Death of the Family.
Death of Jason Todd, yeah. I think he did, yeah. So that you know, has the Joker killing off Batman's second sidekick, Jason Todd, who was Robin at that time. And that leads into another great comic book story, which is Under the Red Hood, which is another great animated movie. Highly recommend that as well. I've not read Death of the Family yet, not finished it yet. But I've heard that one's quite good. That's Scott Snyder.
Yeah, yeah, it's good. It's really good. It's been a long time since I've read it, but it's I think like what's got like because for quite a long time in that sort of New 52 run, they left the Joker well alone. And I think Scott Snyder wanted to take his time on doing a Joker story that was really, really memorable. And yeah, that's probably one of the New 52 Joker is probably one of the scariest incarnations of the Joker you'll see.
I think the Arkham games are really good.
Oh yeah, super.
Again, it's basically the animated series again, but in a kind of a video game form. So highly recommend that as well. Yeah, the Joker will always be a go-to for
everyone. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And especially in Batman stories.
And he's such a chaotic character. He's a gift to writers as well, because he can be pretty much whatever you want him to be. I think one of my favorite Joker moments is not in the comics, but it's like, how can you make your audience fall in love with a character with just one little magic trick?
Yeah.
With just one little disappearing pencil.
Yeah.
So I remember seeing that in the cinema in the IMAX in Manchester and just being like, holy shit, they went there.
Yeah. And that is, that's some, I think you were saying earlier about you don't have to show that kind of dark element. Like, you didn't have to show any of that.
No.
Gruesome. Like, the head going down, the pencil and everything, you don't actually see anything.
No.
It's all left up to your imagination. Intense and terrifying.
Yeah, yeah, it's a big Hitchcock thing.
Don't see it.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. The scariest thing is the thing that happens in your head. Yeah,
exactly. I think we've covered it.
It's been a pleasure talking Joker with you.
I'm really glad that I got you back on. I know we kind of do these commentaries and stuff a lot, but I'm really glad I got you on to talk about a comic.
Comics!
And like we used to do, because I think that was one of the best thing, the most enjoyable parts of Nerdify was going, this comic is amazing.
Graphic novel of the week.
Graphic novel of the week. You know, and Josh would, take his sweet time reading it.
That was our sort of like excuse to educate Josh in the ways of comics.
Pretty much. You would bring a DC one, I bring a Marvel one, and then I'd be like, I'm bringing a DC one, and you're like, well, I'll bring a Marvel one.
Yeah, totally.
It was a lot of fun, and I think Josh, like, for the most part, he enjoyed them, I think, for the most part. But it was nice to get a kind of more of a, like, it's still a nerdy voice, but like slightly outside the
He's a nerd amongst nerds.
Exactly. And I think it was a lot of fun. And I do miss those podcasts, all of us together, but I'm keeping the fire alive.
I'm always happy to return to Prattleworld whenever you're happy to have me.
And I as much as possible, whenever I can fit you in, obviously I like having as many kind of varied guests as I can.
Yeah, yeah, big time.
And talk about, I get the experts on for the subject, I get the experts on. So if it's Batman, I get you on.
Thanks, mate.
You know, if it's somebody, something else, not necessarily just Batman, but all the other stuff, if I think you'll have something decent to say, I always, this is what I like. I like to learn and I like
it's
to...
It's nice to be considered knowledgeable about anything, really. So I take it. Whatever you have to give, I'll take it.
No problem. Well, we're going to round this up by telling you where to find ourselves on the social medias. So I believe you're at...
At DL Keatis, that's KEATIS. Yeah.
Yes, and that's on Twitter.
That's on Twitter.
Can you find that?
I'm on Instagram under the same name, I believe. Yeah, yeah. But if you like pictures of my hot toys, that's pretty much all you're going to get, I'm afraid.
I actually do. Well, I mean, most people just put up pictures of their kids, so I can see that's kind of.
They're like, my babies, so yeah, babies. That makes sense.
Yeah, babies. So it's fine. You can find me at. Good question. I can't even remember myself.
Secret Wars, isn't
Secret
it?
Secret Wars. I've gone all wrong.
I'm pretty sure you're Secret _ Wars, not that I'm stalking you or anything.
Go on. And you know what? In fact, on Facebook, if you type in the search bar, I'm at Secret Wars. On Twitter, I'm Dan, at Dan _
Oh, it's Dan Bors, yes.
Sorry. Even I forgot those. You gave it a good stab.
I tried.
At least you got the underscore. I didn't get any of it.
Thanks, mate.
Who am I again? Instagram, it's Spider Dan Secret Bors. And this podcast is available on Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, and many, many more. Thanks again for joining us in Prattle World for another bit of prattle. I think we both prattled on enough.
Prattled on.
And keep prattling on, everybody. And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.